Hello, it's Victor Perton, That Optimism Man, and another episode of That Optimism Man podcast. Today we have a very special guest. Chelsea Follett is the managing editor of Human Progress, a project of the Cato Institute that seeks to educate the public on global improvements in well-being by providing free empirical data on long-term developments. And Chelsea is the author of the evocative book, Centers of Progress, 40 Cities That Changed the World. You read the book, you will really have a wonderful window to world history and progress. Chelsea, welcome to the Center for Optimism.
Thank you so much for inviting me onto this podcast.
Oh, look, the Optimism podcast, we talk to the most interesting of people, and you certainly meet that. The first question we always ask people when they come to the Center for Optimism and That Optimism podcast is, what makes you optimistic? Is it life experience? Is it faith? Is it mindset?
In my personal life, all of those things apply. But when it comes to being optimistic about the state of the world and society more generally, I think that many people don't realize just how many data points there are in support of a rational optimism about the state of the world. As a managing editor of humanprogress.org, I help run a website that gathers statistics from reliable third-party sources like the UN, the World Bank, individual scholars at respected institutions on all sorts of different metrics of human well-being. You might think from the name humanprogress.org that maybe this has something to do with progressive political ideology, but we're just using the word progress in the most non-controversial, bipartisan way possible. Anything that everyone across the political spectrum, across the world, regardless of their beliefs, would agree generally contributes to human well-being. Literacy, proper nutrition, wealth as opposed to poverty. All of these things can be measured. And if they've improved over time, that is progress. And you can see hundreds of different data sets all related to human well-being on our website. And even though we don't cherry-pick the data, and you can absolutely find some negative trends as well, the overwhelming majority of metrics of well-being have shown considerable improvement, especially over the long run.
I follow you on Twitter. I find it intriguing. Australian liberalism is different from American liberalism, and our founding Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, wrote an essay where he said, "We called the party liberal, not conservative, because we were determined to be progressive and not reactionary, believing in the individual, their rights, and their enterprise." So to me, what I don't understand is how the left now labels itself as progressive and the centre right somehow has relinquished it, to Marxism and soft Marxism. How has that happened?
It's a great question. You can find advocates for progress in all sorts of different political camps, but you also increasingly find people engaging in ideologies of despair and pushing back against progress. You can find them again in different political camps. Some of the more populist movements on the political right, as well as many people on the far left, both engage in sometimes similar rhetoric about how the poor are getting poorer, everything is getting worse around the world, and it can even be apocalyptic if you look at certain elements in the environmental movement, for example. But sometimes from their rhetoric, you would think that we were on the verge of all life on Earth ending. Now, obviously, there are real environmental problems, including climate change and pollution, that we need to contend with. But even in the environmental arena, there are real evidence-based reasons for rational optimism as well. For example, in wealthy countries around the world today, forest area is increasing. In fact, the only regions of the world where deforestation is still increasing would be the poorest areas, such as sub-Saharan Africa, in North America, in East Asia, in Europe. In all of these places, forest area is now on the rise. We're also doing a much better job of conserving many species that were previously declining in number, such as various kinds of whales, wolves. You can find all of this data and more on humanprogress.org. And we're also increasingly decoupling economic growth from harmful emissions to the atmosphere, another positive trend that you can find on the website. So none of this is to say that we should engage in inaction, just sit back and hope that these trends somehow continue on their own. Obviously, human action is what brings about so much of this progress. But when you recognize how much positive change has occurred, I think that can be very heartening and inspire people to continue making the sorts of innovations and positive changes that benefit the planet and everyone.
And when you think of Christina Figueres, who chaired COP in Paris, she has created an enterprise called Stubborn Optimism. And Prince William, the Crown Prince of England, describes himself as a stubborn optimist on climate. And I think even Al Gore, still is out there talking optimism about climate. So my view is that pessimism paralyzes. And the smartest people on climate are optimistic and innovative. And I'm on the board of a water company called Yarra Valley Water. We will be the first water utility in the world that goes net zero next year. And, we've done it on the basis of waste to energy, of some sensible energy conservation. And, we've become a world leader, just by being optimistic, by being brave, and being innovative. And so I'm with you on that. The doomers, if they prevail, we won't get anywhere. But if we celebrate progress, we'll get ahead.
Absolutely. And I think innovation is really key there. The eco-modernist, it's sometimes called, perspective within the environmental movement is definitely the camp that I believe is the way forward. And there have even been studies that show that when you hype up the more apocalyptic versions of environmentalism, actually the reaction to that tends to be that people then tune it all out, they sort of give up and they adopt a fatalistic approach where they no longer actually want to even engage with the issue. But if you instead have a more can-do approach, if you present people with the positive facts, the possibility of positive change here, you get a much more positive reaction. And instead of disengagement, people then suddenly care more about the issue when they believe that instead of being hopeless, there has actually been progress on the issue, and they then know that there is a possibility of continued positive change.
Look, music to my ears. Now, one of the things I'd love to talk about is your wonderful book, Centers of Progress, 40 Cities That Changed the World. And as I Googled your book, and obviously I've got a copy of your book, an interesting author who was actually, again, writing a new book of his own, Alain Bortod, said of your book, "It provides an optimistic, well-documented view of the world. We badly need this long-term perspective." And Peter Gattuso wrote that the book is not just a tale of progress, but also one of optimism about human flourishing. As we look ahead in anticipation of our next center of progress, wherever that may be. So do you want to tell us more about the book and that optimistic long-term perspective that those two critics have shared with us?
Absolutely. So, as managing editor of humanprogress.org, I do spend a lot of time thinking about the conditions that drive progress forward. Obviously, some countries make progress faster than others when it comes to these different indicators. And historically, we've seen economic development reach different countries at different times. What sorts of conditions, what institutions or policies foster the innovations that change human lives? And that simple question of where does progress come from inspired this book. I sat down and I made a list of different aspects of the modern world that we so often take for granted. And if you ever want to feel optimistic, one great way to do it is to just realize that compared to so many of your ancestors, you have won the lottery. And so when you realize just how good that you have it compared to so many people throughout human history, then the possibility of future positive change doesn't sound so crazy. But anyway, I made this list of different aspects of the modern world, and I found that many of them could be traced to particular places. And I didn't start out with the intention that the book would necessarily be about cities, but I found that in so many of these different cases, actually, it was an urban center that you could trace the innovation to. And even in the eras before anything like a city by modern terms existed, the greatest population centers that did exist at the time tended to be the places from which great innovations emerged. So why is that? Well, I have my own theories that you can hear about in the introduction of the book, and I'm sure that we'll get more into that in a moment. But for the different chapters, I just tried to present these easy to digest vignettes of different hopeful moments of progress and innovation throughout history and throughout the world, featuring each city at a different moment in time when it notably contributed to human progress. And it's a very easy read, but at the same time, it also has a lot of facts. No matter how much of a history buff you are, I can guarantee there is at least something in that book that you have not heard of. And it's not just a European history of the world or Western history of the world. It really has so many different cases of different cultures, different points in time that you may not have heard about, contributing to the furtherance of human well-being.
It's I love it. I love the book. As you say, the language is accessible. The little illustrations, just lift you as well. And look, I'm on the board of Yarra Valley Water. I'm on the board of Vic Water, and for some reason, they've made me the ambassador of the Intelligent Water Networks. And I'm probably the dumbest person in the Intelligent Water Networks, but they're about tomorrow's technology today. And trying to adapt them to the water sector. So, the city that drew me that I'd never heard of before, I think I've got the pronunciation right because I asked my ChatGPT, Mohenjo-Daro in what is now in Pakistan, and its advanced sanitation 4,000 years ago. Do you want to tell us about it?
Absolutely. It's something many people don't know about, but the Indus Valley civilization, which we don't know a lot about, we still haven't translated their language. It's very mysterious in some ways. They had actually a more advanced system of sanitation, of plumbing, than even the much allotted system of the later Roman civilization. And now, even though they were able to create this incredibly hygienic system, there's also something a bit dark in this chapter, which is it reminds us that progress is not linear. It's based upon human action. I like that your center advocates for an actionable optimism, a reality-based optimism where you assess what is possible based on what is. And I think that we do need to acknowledge the reality that progress is definitely not linear. Very sadly, there have been so many moments in history when incredible innovations were lost. The conditions for progress actually seem to be quite fragile. There are so many places in this book, which today we might not think of as a center of progress at all. Some of these cities have fallen into ruins. Many of them only were centers of progress for a brief period of time, like a flame that flickered out. So it shone bright. There were these great innovations that changed the world, and then it all collapsed. And so there is a valuable lesson there as well that we need to be vigilant to guard the conditions that allow for progress and innovation.
I teach a subject in the Australian Public Service Academy called Great Public Policy. And we have a foundations and advanced. And I ask the students, I say, what is great policy? And I provoke them. I say, what do you think about Stonehenge? Some priest or priestess 10,000 years ago said, let's cut these 1-ton slabs out of the cliff. Let's drag them 40 Ks. Let's put them on top of each other and create, was it a party venue? Was it a worship venue? But the summer solstice. And 10,000 years later, people are still going there. And in your book, I mean, you do go back 10,000 years. So did those changes 10,000 years ago flicker? Or are we the sons and daughters and granddaughters and grandsons of those optimists that made that happen?
That is a great question. Sometimes people ask, was there a center of progress that had its golden age last longer than all of the others that we can learn from? And It is true that the cities that are featured toward the beginning of the book, as most history books are, it's organized chronologically, starting with the beginnings of permanent settlement and going all the way to the digital revolution. This is a very sweeping overview of history.
I
The
promise not to
earliest.
sing. I promise not to sing "Sitting by the Dock of the Bay" because I used to live in San Francisco and
Wow.
bathed in that optimism and that techno-optimism innovation.
Yes, the techno op the ideas, the attitude of the people in many of these cities undoubtedly was crucial. We can talk a bit about that in a moment, but to first answer that question of yours about the cities that flickered briefly or that lasted longer, the earliest cities in the book tended to have longer periods in which they were featured, but that's not because they were more innovative. Instead, it's because progress in the past, the distant past, was so painfully slow. And as you get closer to the present day, you find that these cities are sometimes featured for only a period of a few decades, but they made so much progress in that period of time. I think that the potential for progress today, with all the cumulative knowledge that we have inherited from all of the people of the past, it's incredible. And so we can definitely make progress faster now, but we still need to be mindful that the conditions for progress are very fragile. And one of the conditions you've alluded to just now, when you talked about the techno optimism of the San Francisco, societal attitudes do seem to be important. One of the best examples of this in the book is probably Amsterdam. And now, if you look at human history, you find that from the time of Julius Caesar and Jesus Christ, all the way up into the Industrial Revolution, human lifespans were practically flat. They grew a little bit, but very, very slowly. And the same thing was true for average income. Our ancestors were very poor, poorer than we can imagine, and they lived very short lives, not just because of the extremely high rate of death in infancy and in childhood, but actually at every age, people had a higher rate of mortality in the past. And then everything changed. Sometimes it's referred to as the hockey stick chart because you see that long flat line suddenly exponentially shooting up like an upward facing blade of a hockey stick as income and lifespans exploded. And scholars disagree on exactly why that was, but most of it would actually trace the beginnings of this incredible liftoff, because it didn't happen in all countries at the same time, to the Dutch Golden Age, and the capital of that was Amsterdam. So how did this place that was at one point an obscure fishing village that no one would have expected to rise up and take the world by storm become the center of a transformation that gave us the modern world? How did it contribute to human prosperity in that way? And I ended up just making the subheading of that chapter openness, because it really does seem to have been related to the prevalent attitude in Amsterdam at the time. The reason that they were able to create so many incredible innovations, one of the earliest stock exchanges, a corporation, all of these incredible advancements in entrepreneurship that created so much prosperity, part of it seems to have been that they had a truly radical openness. This was a city that, during Europe's wars of religion, when it was very unusual for even different factions within Protestantism, it was a Protestant city, to allow the competing factions to operate, they let different sorts of Protestants all preach their views in the city. They even allowed Catholics to operate to some extent. They welcomed in Jewish migrants fleeing various conflicts. They allowed people of so many different faith backgrounds and worldviews to be welcomed into the city. And that was very radical at the time. And it wasn't just the religious differences that they accepted. It was also philosophical differences and political differences. This was a city where John Locke, the father of liberalism, took refuge at a time when his radical views were getting him in trouble elsewhere. Thomas Hobbes, on the other side of the political spectrum, an absolute monarchist, was able to publish his ideas in Amsterdam when no other press in any other city in Europe would touch these views, because in Amsterdam, people believed that no matter how radical or controversial, all of these different ideas, all of these different worldviews, political philosophies, religions, all of these ideas were welcome in a marketplace, and they believed in debate and discussion. And when you have this radical openness to change, to different ideas, different ways of thinking, then that allows for also positive change, the kind of change that can even affect people hundreds of years later, that can truly change the world. And that, I think, is the great lesson of Amsterdam. And I don't talk about optimism specifically, but I do think that there is something optimistic about having that kind of radical openness. When people are not open, when they are closed off to any other worldview and they want to enforce only one way of thinking, it often stems from fear and from a deep pessimism about the possibility of change bringing about negative change. But when you have a more optimistic mindset, when you accept that positive change is also possible, suddenly change doesn't seem so scary. Also, different ideas don't seem so scary, even if they're new or controversial. And you can engage in that kind of radical openness that allowed Amsterdam to flourish.
It so sings to me. The course I was teaching yesterday, we say to the policymakers, you have to talk to people whose views are in conflict with yours. And that notion of radical openness, I call myself a radical optimist. So, in being a radical optimist, and the example I give, because my parents were refugees from the Soviet Union. So, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up when I hear communism and Marxism. And yet, one of my attributes as a policymaker has been to be able to sit down with communists and Marxists and find the common ground that lets us make progress. So, speaking of that, the other thing that sings to me, of course, is your chapter on Berlin. So, my stepfather was a white Russian. His father had been executed in the Russian Revolution. His mother fled to Berlin with him as a baby. And so I know Berlin well, and I knew it when it was a divided city. And of course, your chapter talks about that tearing down of the wall and the tearing down of communism. So tell us more, because nowadays, when they talk about cool cities, the city I live in, Melbourne, and Berlin are often talked about as cool cities. So how did Berlin, a divided city, in some senses a fearful city, secret police, minefields. How did they become such a center of progress for us since 1989 and 90 through to today?
Well, I think that the story of Berlin is almost, it almost reads like a parable about the importance of human liberty. It was a natural experiment in a way, because you had the exact same people, the same culture, the same language, the same background, and yet such different outcomes based on the political and economic system adopted by the two sides of the city. You can see a similar natural experiment playing out today, if you look at North and South Korea and how different metrics of human well-being that you can again find on humanprogress.org have played out in those two different places that are again the same society, the same people, but separated by different economic systems. What happened in Berlin, that chapter on the fall of the Berlin Wall and the beginning of the turn against communism, I think that chapter speaks to one of the key conditions to progress. The cities featured in the book, again, are very diverse. They're from different eras of history. They're from different areas of the world, very different cultures, different continents. And yet, I do think that there are some commonalities. One of them, of course, is just that there are many people in most of them. That's why they tend to be cities. But just having a large population is not enough. Otherwise, every city would produce world-changing innovations, and that's not what we see. There is something else. I would argue that one of the key ingredients to progress is freedom, and not just There are many different kinds of freedom: freedom of speech, freedom of freedom to debate and exchange, as we spoke about in Amsterdam, but also economic freedom. This is a sort of freedom that I don't think gets enough credit for driving progress forward. I think that many people do understand that economic freedom helps to bring about businesses and entrepreneurial ideas on how to uplift living standards by fulfilling different human needs and wants. But I don't think people realize just how many different forms of progress can be traced to economic freedom. And it might be obvious how the technological innovations of Tokyo or the digital revolution in San Francisco stemmed from the free market and its ability to raise living standards. But artistic freedom would be a great example of a sort of freedom people don't normally associate with economic liberty, and yet they do seem historically to be entwined. There's this idea in society today of the starving artist, and that a true artist just creates art for its own sake without any form of reward. And yet, if you look at the places that have created some of humanity's most beloved artworks that have stood the test of time, that people still enjoy today, hundreds of years after their creation, in many of these cities that gave us these great artworks, it was because they made art so incredibly lucrative. Whether we're talking about the classical music of Vienna or the paintings of Renaissance Florence, it was an incredible race to create new artistic innovations because of the funding, because of the artistic patronage, and this environment where the incentive structure aligns human ingenuity toward creating these artworks. That is what gave us these beautiful innovations that we still enjoy today. You can see the results of competition also even in the creation of the novel. This was first invented in medieval Kyoto. People may not realize that. And it was because of a competition amongst courtiers to fund the greatest artworks. It was artistic patronage. Something similar happened in Florence. Florence, many wealthy families, such as the Medicis, we've all heard of, were funding artworks for the prestige it conferred. And in doing so, they drew so many great artists into one place to collaborate and to compete and to create these lasting symbols of human ingenuity and beauty that we still enjoy today. So economic freedom, I think, has really, it's underestimated. People don't realize just how many different aspects of human well-being relate to this profit motive and the competition it incentivizes that all stems from economic freedom.
I think you're aware of the work of Carol Graham from Brookings, the development economist, and her research in Peru and the social mobility of people starting out as peasants, on dirt-floored huts and being able to rise up in society. And she attributes that to optimism and hustle. You've got five corn cobs, you barbecue them and you sell them on a street corner. It's summertime and people are driving to the beach. You sell beach bowls by the beach. And Carol's work on this, I think, is really, really interesting. That notion of economic freedom, starting at the peasant level. And in fact, some of her more interesting work recently is on the difference in, say, the Rust Belt of America and the progress being made by Latino migrants and, African Americans who were investing in the education of their kids and, the optimism associated with spirituality and family and the like. So I think that what I love with my conversations with Carol Graham is, you don't have to be heading up Amazon and you don't have to be heading up Tesla. It works for people at the level of the small farm holding or the level of the small enterprise. Now, I'm going to be a bit selfish. I live in Melbourne, and Melbourne, is a city of nearly 5 million people. We were 7 years running the world's most livable city. We've got one of the world's leading cancer centers. We've got three great universities. But COVID really had a deep undermining effect. We have the longest lockdown in the world. There was some incredible either conservatism or radicalism in our government in requiring us to stay at home and stay away from work. So the city doesn't feel, the same way that it felt pre-COVID. So everything you've learned about these 40 cities and, running your wonderful, wonderful enterprise on sharing the facts of human progress, what do we need to do in Melbourne so that we are chapter 41 or 42 of your second edition?
Well, I don't think that even if you ensure all of the right conditions for progress are there, that you guarantee you'll come up with a world-changing innovation, but you do increase your chances. So what sort of lessons can we learn from these different cities and can we apply to Melbourne or to any other city? Well, first of all, freedom, the policies and institutions, of openness that can be attained usually more at a country level today. I know in Australia right now, there is a piece of legislation meant to combat misinformation, but that could also, many fear, have a dramatic negative impact on freedom of speech. So that's something to keep in mind. But of course, freedom of speech is not just about the legal environment, it's also a cultural thing. And so within the city of Melbourne itself, you can foster a sort of, again, radical openness, a fearless optimism, and encourage that debate and civil discourse across different viewpoints so that people are allowed, or they feel truly allowed, to discuss new ideas, even ideas that might seem a little bit crazy, and maybe you'll come up with an idea that changes the world for the better. And what you were saying about even people in the worst of circumstances, peasants in dire poverty, being able to improve their situation. That really, I think, it speaks to the chapter on Hong Kong in the book, which is featured for its whirlwind economic transformation in the 1960s and 70s, when it went from one of the poorest places in the world. I don't think people realize just how impoverished Hong Kong once was. The levels of poverty that were seen at the time were similar to some places in sub-Saharan Africa today, truly dire poverty. And it transformed very rapidly into one of the wealthiest and most cosmopolitan cities on the planet. Wow. I mean, that, if you can figure that out, that is a recipe for success that can then be applied to so many places around the world. So, what was Hong Kong's secret? And it seems to be a policy of non-interventionism, stepping back. There was a very bold civil servant named Sir John Cowperthwaite. He's been referred to as Hong Kong's architect of prosperity, not because he came up with some brilliant top-down policy that created the wealth of Hong Kong, but because he drew back the government and allowed the people of Hong Kong the freedom to rebuild their city after a devastating war, to operate their businesses with less regulation and red tape than many other people around the world. And so rapidly, once they were freed, once the innovative potential and the entrepreneurship of the people of Hong Kong was released, the city just took the world by storm. It transformed so rapidly. But again, that chapter, like the one on Mohenjo-Daro that we discussed earlier, also has a sort of depressing element to it because it reminds us that the conditions for positive change, for progress, can very easily be lost. Obviously, Hong Kong today is no longer the city that it was during the era when it is featured in this book. The Chinese Communist Party has transformed the city of Hong Kong again, but in a different direction. And so many of the pillars upon which Hong Kong's success were founded, economic liberty, civil liberties, fiscal poverty, all of these things have now been stripped away. And so it's a cautionary tale. But again, I think that gets into your version of optimism being very much down to earth. It's a rational optimism. It's reality based. You do have to look at the negative trends as well and be aware of them so that you can avoid those pitfalls and so that we can treasure the freedom that we do have and prevent it from crumbling away, recognizing that constant vigilance is required to prevent these very fragile conditions for progress from going away.
Yeah, thinking about Melbourne, the number of refugees and migrants. So in Australia, nearly 50% of the population are migrants or the kids of migrants. And so the Hong Kongers who've moved here have come here to escape communism and to bring that spirit of freedom. And I often share the statistic that a refugee living in Melbourne or a migrant living in Melbourne is more optimistic than the native-born population. And everyone that moves here tends to bring that. And I spoke on Australia Day at the African Communities event. And, sometimes there's debate about Australia Day and, does it represent white colonization, etc. But when you spend Australia Day with 200 African migrants and refugees and their kids, there's something to celebrate. Now, look, I wanted to share something with you. The University of Sydney published a really interesting study called the Optimism Effect. So they crunched 25 years of OECD data, and their conclusion is that optimism is the key driver at both a national and organizational level of investment formation, productivity, innovation, and national success. Now, I reckon it sounds aligned to your mission and to your book. So, is Sydney University right? The optimism effect. Optimism drives capital formation, innovation, and productivity.
I would not be working at a think tank if I didn't believe in the possibility of ideas to change the world. I think that the ways that we think about the world, that we conceptualize it, absolutely have an effect. At the same time, it's also true that if someone is living in a society that is very illiberal, very authoritarian, and that limits their capacity to innovate, to exchange, to create positive change, then having a can-do attitude and a positive mindset, that might still help in the sense that maybe it will inspire them to change the economic and political system in which they live. But if they're truly being oppressed, that alone will not be enough. So my counter to that is that it's also the policies and the institutions that we adopt that matter an incredible amount. If you are an optimist in an oppressive regime, obviously, I hope that you harness that can-do attitude to create an environment that's more conducive to progress. And I think that when you have that in combination with then the policies, the institutions that actually allow you the freedom to create, that is what truly leads to progress.
I am still thinking of my grandmother who went to the Gulag for 12 years. And then, as Lithuania started to develop its freedom movement, after the first rally of Sąjūdis, she said to me, "I'm going to outlive communism." And she took part in the Million Hands. And, when Yeltsin was standing on the tank, and declaring that the end of the Soviet Union, the end of communism, of course, I rang her. And she said, "I'm watching on CNN." So for me, at the family level, that even in the most oppressive of regimes, that light, that desire for human freedom and that desire for justice is so powerful. So I'm very fortunate in my family, to have a maternal line, a female line of great optimists, who could continue that optimism in the face of crushing dictatorship. And my mum used to tell the story. She'd lived under Stalin and Hitler. And then she said, coming to Australia, and our prime minister when she arrived here was Menzies. She said, "I love the fact that in Australia you could say bloody Menzies and no one would lock you up." So that for me, right from the earliest childhood, that notion of freedom of speech was so important. So if we come back to what we talked about earlier, the environmental movement and climate change, and you talked about indicators that should give us optimism about the future of environmental stewardship and forested areas, and there are so many positive stories, and yet when I read about the small island states, it's all doomerism. And all the incentives at the United Nations and elsewhere is for their prime ministers and presidents to appear and attack the West and attack, capitalism and the like. So how do we get around that? I know, you're very much committed, to human freedom, to free enterprise. How do we tell the stories that counter, this incentive to the small states now to go to the United Nations, to go to COP and be as negative as hell?
I think that there are a couple of different approaches you can take. What you're doing, I think, is incredibly important because so much of the degrowth movement and the more negative strains of environmentalism do stem from this doomer mindset, as you say, this sort of surrendering, giving up, the idea that we shouldn't even try to increase the standard of living. We should actually be reducing the standard of living because that's the best we can hope for. That's the best we can do. Otherwise, the world will become unlivable. Pushing back against that and encouraging people to have more of a positive can-do mindset, a solutions-oriented approach, I think is very valuable. But another thing that you can do is direct people to websites and resources like humanprogress.org that encourage an evidence-based, a data-based view of the state of the world to help people see that again, economic growth is not the enemy. There's something called the environmental Kuznets curve, whereby when a country initially starts to industrialize, obviously that increases pollution for a time. But after a country hits a certain level of income, suddenly that actually reverses. Once people become wealthy enough that they're not worried about their own survival, they're no longer, in a state where they have to choose between feeding their family, or the life of maybe an endangered animal. Obviously, if you're in that situation, you're going to kill the endangered animal to feed your own family. Once you're at a certain level of prosperity, suddenly you're able to care about environmental stewardship. And we do find that wealthier countries are able to conserve their environments at a higher level. Again, this is why we see so many trends like the trends of forestation, a forest area increasing in wealthy countries while they're still decreasing in many poorer areas of the world. And so embracing economic growth and recognizing the different ways that innovation can help the environment, the ways that we can find substitutes for rare resources, we can find ways to do more with less, we can dematerialize with new technologies. Think about all the different objects that your cell phone in your pocket, your smartphone replaces. A radio, a map, a clock. The list is actually endless. The more apps you can you think about that you have in that tiny compact device, but which before you need rooms and rooms of different devices to do the same amount of things that tiny device can do for you. There are so many different ways that innovation can help us out of different environmental challenges that we face. Yes, progress does sometimes create problems. It can create pollution. It can create all of these different issues that we have to work through, but it can also create the solutions. And we have to remember that there are so many different challenges in the past that our species worried would be world-ending, would be catastrophic. And many of these horrific problems, after solving them, well, we've now forgotten about different public health issues that were faced because we created a solution and we have, in many cases, not only eradicated problems, but even the memories of these problems existing. Climate change is a problem, but it is ultimately, just like all the other problems we faced, a problem whose solution lies in human ingenuity, human innovation. And so rather than seeing human beings as the enemy, as a cancer on the planet, rather than seeing economic growth as the enemy, we need to think, how can we use these tools we have, the human mind, prosperity, modern prosperity, to combat the problems that we face and to find solutions?
Beautifully put. I run a little personal campaign. In Australia, we have this scarcity mentality around water. And yet, the cities that are on the ocean We've got unlimited capacity to use desalination, recycling, stormwater capture. We can use renewable energy to power them. And so my campaign is one, where we need to start thinking abundance rather than scarcity. And so too in energy as well. And no, you sing to me when you say that. So one of my arguments is that you can't be innovative unless you're optimistic. That the pessimist cannot innovate because you've got to go on and on in the face of failure. So, for instance, I always use the example of Dyson, the vacuum cleaner guy, and he had 5,000 iterations of the bagless vacuum cleaner, 15 years of trial and error before he achieved success. And you think of an entrepreneur like Branson or an inventor like Edison. The secret source of innovation is optimism, getting past failure or treating a failed experiment as the way to success. So what do you reckon? If you're employing someone to innovate at your institute, would you employ an optimist or a pessimist?
HumanProgress.org, we like to say that we promote realism rather than optimism because even though so much of the evidence does point toward an optimistic mindset, it's a rational optimism. It's not just optimism out of thin air. It's based on something, on data, on evidence. I do think that having an optimistic spirit can help people be more innovative, but it's also incentives. So many people, it's true, don't even ever try to create a world-changing invention. Most people don't. But people are more likely to make the attempt when the incentives encourage them to. There's a theory that progress is advanced the most during times of war that some people have. And it is true that wars tend to drive forward certain kinds of technological advancement in weaponry, for example. And this comes from competition. That's true. People also compete during peacetime. It's just that they're not competing to kill and destroy each other. They're competing to try to better their fellow human beings' lives by creating different services and products and innovations in a market system to improve their lives, to serve the customer, right? And so the kind of progress that actually raises living standards, I argue, in the centers of progress actually is more prevalent in peacetime than in war. So many of the greatest, most innovative centers of progress throughout history have been at peace. And that gets back into what we were talking about with economic incentives as well. Yes, art was often created where it was made the most lucrative, but also other kinds of innovation came about thanks to economic incentives as well. Many people don't realize that writing, one of the most basic aspects of the modern world, actually came about not because people were writing poetry or because they wanted to record the family tree of a king, something like that might be what you imagine the origin of writing to be. Actually, the earliest writings were made by accountants. These were shopping receipts, these were inventory lists and other financial records. And the Principia of Isaac Newton, the culmination of the scientific revolution, many people don't realize that it was actually funded by the heir to a soap mogul. Once again, it was free enterprise that was able to support forms of innovation that we might not even normally associate with economic freedom or with those financial incentives. So I think that allowing for a system where the incentive structure aligns human creativity with fulfilling human needs rather than encouraging people to use their creative energies to destroy one another or to put those into other directions, I think that is at least as important as optimism in driving forward positive change.
And I think it's brilliant when you look at progress, post World War II and the like, and how it accelerated in that time of peacetime, and people having children because they were confident that the children would have a good life, rather than misery. So you'd be very generous because I know it's getting quite late where you are. But if I could just share something with you from our Centre for Optimism. So we've done 10 years of research now, and our basic question is asking people from the highest people in society, to people on the street. We ask them, what makes you optimistic, as I did at the beginning. And we've synthesized that our view now is the optimism principle is the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. What do you reckon?
If it is a rational optimism, absolutely. I think that the reason that we see so many ideologies of despair today, whether it is in a negative form of environmentalism, or whether it is the idea that our economic system has utterly failed us and needs to be destroyed, and we need to try something new from the ground up. All of these incredibly negative, despairing worldviews, I think, stem not just from an attitude that people were born with, but from a lack of understanding of the data, of what the actual evidence says. So many different forms of progress can be measured. We do have data on them. And if you look at the long-term trends, humanity has come a long way by looking at the past, by learning from where we've been and recognizing just how far we've come, how much progress we've made, we can start a conversation then about how we've made that progress. What sorts of conditions, what sorts of policies, what sorts of institutions, and yes, what sorts of mindsets have helped humanity achieve all that we have and will allow us to continue to make positive change. I think that is key.
I am again, what you say. I love Hans Rosling's book Factfulness, which sings of this, or even Bill Gates and Steven Pinker from Harvard, who also talk about that, or Our World in Data at Oxford, which again, like you, it shares the good and the bad, but the inevitable conclusion of the world in data is that the world is getting better, and obviously, I can see you via video, and the people can hear the sound of your voice on this podcast and that upbeat positivity. So, perhaps as we're concluding, what are your tips and tricks that keep you so optimistic, realistically optimistic? And how can people share that worldview of yours of progress, which isn't linear, but if we persist, we'll get ahead? So, how do you do it, Chelsea?
I'm so glad that you mentioned Dr. Pinker of Harvard University, because he is one of our advisory board members actually at humanprogress.org. And he has a lot of tips related to your question. As a psychologist, he's written extensively about the different psychological biases that predispose human beings toward pessimism, whether that is having a rose-colored view of the era of your own childhood or youth when you were healthier, but also probably when the technology was a lot worse and there were a lot of bad things that looking back you've forgotten about, because you're just focused on your own positive memories of when you were carefree and young and healthy. He talks about also how in the ancestral environment, being extremely vigilant against threats, even hypervigilant, overreacting rather than underreacting to any potential threat, probably helped many of our ancestors survive. If there was a rustling in the bushes and you jumped and you panicked and you ran away, even if it turned out to be a little bunny rabbit, there was always a chance that it was actually a predator, right, who could harm you. And so people who
I live
overreact
in
and panic,
Australia. We have tiger snakes and crocodiles.
right, I don't need to tell you about all of that, but being hypervigilant to threats probably did help many of our ancestors to survive and pass down their genes to us. We just have to be aware of these biases, though, and realize that being hypervigilant, it can actually become detrimental to your survival if this tendency to focus on the negative and to panic, even about things that aren't actually threats, causes you then to throw away the policies and institutions that underpin modern prosperity. So we just have to be aware of many of these biases. I would say another very important tip if you find yourself struggling with negativity would be to compare downward rather than upward. So many of the most damaging ideologies in history, such as communism and fascism, which I know your family had a very personal experience with, they've stemmed from utopian thinking, comparing the present moment, the current state of things, to an impossible ideal. We should actually be comparing to the past, comparing to the realistic alternatives. When we look at the present, instead of asking, how does the present moment differ from paradise, from an absolute state of ideal perfection? We should ask, how does it compare to the vast majority of human history? How does our country compare to a poorer country in a different area of the world? How, when we make those more realistic comparisons to actual existing alternatives or alternatives that have existed instead of hypothetical ideal societies, we find that actually places like Australia and the United States, we've come a long way and the standard of living is pretty high. And instead of throwing all of that away, yes, things could get better. We can make improvements, but we cannot throw away the baby with the bathwater. We need to make sure that any changes that we make do not tear away the very foundations of our success. And that again gets into the importance of studying history and gaining historical perspective and having those conversations then about what is it that drives progress forward. So, in a nutshell, historical perspective. Read history, look at data, recognize how far we've come. If that doesn't help you feel optimistic, I don't know what will.
I remember Steven Pinker saying, anyone who remembers the good old days has got a bad memory. So you're very fortunate to have him on your advisory board. So Chelsea, thank you so much for spending your time with us and inspiring us. I commend to everyone Centers of Progress, 40 Cities That Changed the World. I follow Chelsea on Twitter. And Chelsea, what are the other ways people can follow your work and support your work?
I would encourage anyone who enjoyed this podcast to sign up for the Human Progress newsletter, the Doom Slayer, to follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, the website formerly known as Twitter, now X, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube. We have our own podcast, actually, the Human Progress podcast. I urge you to check it out. And I encourage anyone who enjoyed this talk to also check out my colleague's book, Heroes of Progress, 65 People Who Changed the World by my former colleague, Alexander Hammond, as well as the books by my colleague, Marion Tupi, Superabundance, which is about, it's a sort of counter to the resource scarcity alarmism we so often hear, and also 10 Global Trends That Every Smart Person Should Know, and many more that you will find interesting. It's this beautiful sort of coffee table book that just has so many of the highlights of the data sets that you can find on human progress that are presented in book form. And it can start conversations, I think, when you have a book like that in your living room. So please check out those books as well. And I'd also just encourage people again to keep an eye on potential threats to progress as well, such as that legislation in Australia today that could limit freedom of speech, something to keep an eye on. And keep having that can-do positive attitude, though, about our potential as human beings to make so much progress when given the freedom to do so.
Well, you have been wonderful and you've been generous. And from the bottom of my heart and from all of our listeners, thank you and best wishes as we end 2024 and enter 2025. And hopefully it will be a period of even greater peace. Although when we go back to Steven Pinker, he would say, even with the wars that are going on now, the world has probably never been more peaceful and people probably live safer lives than they certainly did in that period when they were worried about the saber-toothed tiger coming out of that rustling grass. So, Chelsea, thank you very much. Best wishes, and we look forward to supporting your work and staying in touch.
Thank you.